Hello and welcome to Batflips and Nerds, the baseball podcast with a British twist. I'm Darius Austin and we're very excited to bring you a special guest this week. Joining me for the guest is the other resident stat nerd on the team. It's Russell Easton. Russell, how are you?
I'm doing good, thanks. Yourself, Darius?
Yeah, very well. We're both very excited about this pod. I think a lot of the listeners will be too, because joining us all the way from the States is Mike Petriello of MLB.com, a StatCast expert. In residence. Mike, thank you very much for joining us.
Gentlemen, thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk some baseball.
Yeah, we're really looking forward to it, and we've got a lot to ask. So before we kind of dig into our questions, just kind of wanted to get you to introduce yourself to the listeners for anybody who hasn't listened to the StatCast podcast or read your articles. So kind of what is your role over at MLB.com? What kind of things do you do with the team and kind of just how is it set up over there, really?
Sure. Yeah. So my name is Mike Petriello, as you mentioned, and I do work at MLB.com, where I've been for, I guess, a little over 3 years now. Before that, I wrote for FanGraphs and I wrote for ESPN and some smaller sites before that. So what I do here at MLB.com, I do a bunch of different things, I guess, but primarily I work on the StatCast project. And for those who don't know what that is, ever since the 2015 season, there's been a series of cameras and radars installed in each of the 30 major league parks. So now you can measure things that you've never been able to measure before that. Certainly, I think everyone's heard of terms like exit velocity and spin rate and launch angle. All of that comes out of the StatCast technology. And it's a lot of fun and it's fascinating and it's a lot of work to dig through this immense amount of data and try to, you know, build stories out of it or create metrics in a way that people could understand and use. So I spent a lot of my time working with the other members of the team, like Tom Tango and Darren Willman and all sorts of other people. I help explain some of this stuff to some of our network of beat writers, some of whom have been around for, you know, a long time. And do great work, but, you know, maybe need a little extra help in the stat nerd department. And, you know, sometimes I just write articles that have nothing to do with stats either. Like, we should make some trades, the kind of meat and potatoes baseball stuff. So it's a pretty good gig. I get to go on TV sometimes. As you mentioned, we do have our weekly StatCast podcast, which is a lot of fun to do. And it's basically a dream job. I can't complain.
Yeah, it sounds pretty good to us, I have to say.
Yeah, I just got a quick question, Mike. What is like the size of the StatCast team? Obviously, you spoke about yourself, Tom, and Darren, who's your visualization expert, but how many people is there in total?
You know, it's a great question, and I don't entirely know the answer to that, and I know that sounds crazy, and that is because not everybody is here in the New York office with me. You know, we've got the people like myself and Tom and Darren and Jason and Travis Peterson, who, you know, the data experts, but there's also a lot of people who are tasked with installing and maintaining the hardware, you know, like at each of the parks and calibrating them. And then in Arizona at Salt River Fields, that's kind of our test bed. It's also where the Rockies and Diamondbacks play during the spring training. But we have a lot of people out there who, you know, they're always working on new ways to use the equipment there. So I don't really know the answer to that because they're just not all here, but it's more than a few, I can tell you that.
Yeah, I'm sure. I guess these days it's increasingly difficult to get a handle on exactly how many people you're working with.
Yeah, it's a lot of people doing a lot of different things. And I think what's maybe not so apparent from the outside is that there are a lot of different audiences that use this, right? Like I think most people think about it in terms of, you know, metrics that go out on Baseball Savant or articles we write or things you see on TV. And that's all true. But there are a lot of other, you know, uses for this data, you know, for partners and kind of as a replacement for pitch effects. This goes into like the main stat database. And now we've got this whole like MGM thing, the betting that's legal now. So there's a lot of different uses for this. And it's a lot of people who are working on it in very different ways. It's not just for like what kind of stats can we come up with.
Yeah, absolutely. So we kind of wanted to start with the stats questions from a simple standpoint. Obviously, we have a lot of listeners who are pretty new to baseball in general, as well as the stats side of the game. So you spend quite a lot of time, I think, trying to convey the stats in a fairly easy to understand way through your writing, through the podcast. So what is the kind of go-to stat or stats you would kind of recommend beginners to look at, and how do you think is the best way to introduce the StatCast data within that? And what do you think the ideal entry point is if you're kind of trying to pitch StatCast to people?
Yeah, it's a great question. If I have any talent at all, and I'm not actually sure that I do, to translate this incredibly complicated stuff in a way that, you know, a regular baseball fan will be able to understand. Like, we did this StatCast broadcast on ESPN2 of the wildcard game last year, and it was an extra inning game, so it was like a 5-hour broadcast. And obviously, a main task for me was explaining this in a way that is interesting and entertaining and won't turn people off and drown them in numbers. So, I mean, to answer your question, I think the very simplest thing is probably exit velocity, which is very simply, how hard did the hitter hit the ball? You know, we've had pitch velocity, for like 10 or 11 years through pitch effects, and really for decades before that, if you had access to a radar gun. But we've never really been able to say, how hard does someone hit the ball? And, you know, we can put a lot of numbers to that, but I also like that it's intuitive. I mean, hit the ball hard, and good things will happen. You know, if you are, let's say, Billy Hamilton, he's got a lot of skills. He's very fast. He's a great outfielder. He cannot hit the ball hard. And that's sort of what has made him, you know, a below average player. So that's the very first thing I look at, because, you know, you can put the ball in play and a lot of different things can happen. But I want to know, do you have a skill to crush this ball? Because I feel like there's a lot of things that can be taught. You know, you can teach someone to, you know, change their footwork or change their swing or maybe make more contact, but you can't really teach a guy to hit the ball hard. That seems like it's a skill you kind of have or don't, unless maybe you put on a ton of muscle. So that's the very first thing to me. You know, you can get deeper into stuff than that. Like, spin rate is really interesting. You know, it tells you a lot about how the pitches move, but that's sort of like a little bit deeper thing. And you can't really see it. Like, if I tell you someone hit the ball 110 miles an hour, you're not going to watch that video and say, oh, that didn't look like much to me. You know, it's probably going to look like the numbers. So for me, that's always the first thing. And I also just like the things we couldn't measure before. We can measure foot speed now with our metric sprint speed. You know, I think in the past you try to eyeball it or say this guy had a lot of stolen bases. Well, now there's a number for it, which is cool. So what I really like is just being able to put numbers to these things you've been arguing about for years. Like, you know, decades ago, you might have argued about whether Roberto Clemente had the strongest throwing arm. Well, if you play today, maybe we can actually tell you the answer to that.
Cool, Mike. You quickly mentioned it there, but this season you got the chance to be part of the stats broadcast for one of the postseason games. How was that for you? And like, how was that different to obviously like the more traditional work you do via the podcasts and the writing of articles?
Yeah, that was maybe the most fun I've ever had in my entire life. It was myself and Eduardo Perez, who played in the big leagues for a long time, and Jason Benetti, who is the Chicago White Sox broadcaster, and who I just had Mexican food with about 90 minutes ago. Who is my favorite person on earth. He's great. It was a second screen broadcast, which means that it was not the only broadcast on ESPN. There was still the main, you know, Alex Rodriguez, Jessica Mendoza, Matt Viscardo team that you'd see all year long. But they gave us the chance to do a completely separate broadcast alongside them on ESPN2. And it was really cool. It was a little nerve-wracking at first, because if you remember how the season ended, there were two playoff games before the playoffs. So, you know, we flew into Chicago not knowing which teams would be in the game the next day, or even if we were going to have to drive to Milwaukee, depending on how this is going to work out. So that was kind of fun. We were very, very fortunate that the game itself was awesome. You know, a 1-1 game in extra innings. It's always difficult to make a blowout seem interesting. So the gods were smiling on us in that day. It was a lot of fun because, you know, we did all these graphics and stats and all this cool stuff that you'd never seen on a game before. But what I think people liked the most, the most meaningful feedback I heard, was that it wasn't so much about all the cool stuff we added as it was about maybe some of the stuff we didn't add. Like, you know, all the old cliches and the somewhat meaningless stats. And, you know, baseball has changed so much, not even, you know, in decades, over the last 5 years, you know, baseball has changed an immense amount. Shifts, right? And launch angle and strikeouts and spin rate and all of it. And I really feel like what you need to be able to do is to explain to people why this is happening. And it is a broadcast. You don't have a lot of time to get into concepts, so you got to be able to do it quickly. But if the whole point is to explain what's happening on the field, then you need to be able to understand why the teams are making these decisions. And they are certainly not looking at pitcher wins or RBIs to decide why guys are shifting or doing any of that. So it was really a lot of fun. And the feedback was great. And I'm really hopeful we get the opportunity to do more next year, because I think hopefully we showed people that a nerd show could still be entertaining and informative, as it was for us.
Yeah, that's cool to hear that you enjoyed it so much. So this is maybe a more difficult question, but given the choice, would you go full-time to being a broadcaster if you were given the option to cover 162 games in a season in that style?
I wouldn't say 162, just in the sense that I have a growing family and a pregnant wife, and I don't know how cool she'd be with that, but if we were able to do it on a weekly or monthly basis or something like that, absolutely. I'm pretty sure broadcast pays more than writing anyway, so I'd be very much into that. But it's cool because, you know, there's a lot of people who write, and it's tough to stand out. And there's very few people who get to do that kind of thing on the air. And I'm very aware of how fortunate I was to even get that opportunity to do that. And it really worked out. So I would love to be able to do it more. And really, I hope it's some sort of hybrid role, because I don't really want to give up writing either. But it would be nice if I could do a little bit of both going forward.
And with someone like Jason Benetti, I'm guessing you were able to talk to Jason quite a bit. Do you get the sense that he spends a lot of time personally looking at the more modern side of things at the sites and graphs, baseball prospectus? Does he look at StatCast data a lot, or are these things that people within the broadcast team are providing to him before the games, you know, in a more digested format for him to use?
Well, I know that he does, but I think that he might be a little bit of an outlier in that case. Jason is great, and he's very inquisitive, and he wants to make sure he's up to date, and he wants to push forward his broadcast in any way he can. So he texts me and he asks me questions. I don't know that a lot of broadcasters do that. I think some of them do. I mean, if you think about 30 teams, each have a couple guys in the booth. That's a lot of different, you know, backgrounds. Some are former players, some aren't. So you can imagine how that goes. Some of the guys are actively resistant to learning anything about anything. And, you know, some of them are interested, but don't think there's a place for it on broadcast. It's different per team and per market. I think the guys who do the Astros broadcasts are super into it. And I think that's partially because the Astros are one of the peak nerd teams right now, you know? So I think that they think that's a good way to explain things to their audience. I think, you know, Tampa Bay is probably a similar way. So, you know, we have relationships with a lot of them. Some guys just want to know, you know, the very top level thing, like, what can I do to show something interesting about my guys, and maybe they're not all in. And there are a couple guys who we talk to somewhat regularly. So it's Jason is probably like the 1% there. And it's a little inconsistent from market to market, I would say.
Yeah, that definitely seems like the impression I get from listening to different broadcasts. On the topic of the audiences and how people consume the broadcasts, you seem to get a pretty good reception to the ones you did this year. The StatCast space broadcast, but you kind of always get with any, say, metric writing or content, I think there's some pushback from the people who prefer the old school style of things. And we'll probably have an audience here in the UK next year who are maybe in many cases watching a baseball broadcast for the first time if it ends up being live on the BBC, for example, like the NFL games are. So do you think that's an opportunity for people to be more receptive to that kind of use of data, or do you find that it's just kind of a broad spread regardless of how people have consumed their baseball in the past?
That's a really interesting question. I hadn't thought about it like that, just because, you know, in the UK, you're not going to have people with the same, you know, decades long history of growing up with the same stats. I think, you know, a lot of the pushback here, let me phrase it this way. The nerds won, right? Like nerds are in the front offices. Like, you know, you look at the general managers, half of them or more, you know, haven't even played the game. They're all, you know, nerds from these small schools. So that war is over. You know, nobody actually looks at batting average and pitcher wins as an indicator of skill. But I do think part of the pushback here to some of that is some of this stuff is just so new. And, you know, I remember growing up in the 80s and thinking like, wow, a 300 average is cool. And this, you know, this guy won 21 games. That's really cool. And those are the numbers you grew up with. And those are the numbers that for a lot of people help make you fall in love with the game. And, you know, I try to, maybe I don't do a good enough job of this, but I try to be cognizant of that when I nudge people towards new numbers and they're still insisting on using the old ones. But it's interesting from your point of view. I don't know, you know, I don't know how long people in the UK have been following. I don't know if they can look back to the numbers they shared with their moms or dads growing up. And maybe if this is kind of their first exposure to, you know, baseball stats kind of in general, if you know the quote unquote right ones are presented, maybe they'll just think this is what we're supposed to be using. I don't know if that's what's going to happen. I don't actually really know who's calling these games or presenting the games, but I really hope that's the case, because this seems like a fertile new ground. And I've been astounded by the amount of UK fans I've found on Twitter recently. It's really a cool thing to see this kind of passion in a new part of the world for baseball, at least.
Yeah, we don't really know. I don't think we certainly seem to find that people are relatively receptive to stats, I think, on the whole. But again, it's in a similar way. We don't have much of a benchmark to compare to in terms of, you know, the percentage of American fans who watch the game there. And I think the kind of people you encounter maybe on Twitter are perhaps just more inclined towards statistical usage when they're watching the game anyway. So it is difficult to know how it compares, I think.
Well, let me ask you guys, you know, obviously football, you know, soccer being your sport, has there been a statistical sort of revolution there that's been tough for people to swallow? I'm really not familiar with it, but I know that's obviously the most popular game there.
It's starting. There is a company called Opto based in the UK, which has a lot of sports statistics and a lot around soccer and football. And they've started to introduce things, something called expected goals, which is effectively takes the number of shots a striker has taken and where they took them from to say, well, actually, they should have scored 15 out of these 20 shots. So that's their expected goals, and compared it to how many they did score to see if a striker was better than he should be or whether he was worse than he should be. So they're starting to leak out there. There is still some reticence, in my opinion, from what I've seen from people go like, nah, it doesn't matter. So I think we still have it in football when people get represented with stats, which they're not used to. They just kind of, well, it doesn't explain the game well enough.
Yeah, I think that's very similar over here. And it's just based on people's experience of decades of doing it one way. And then all of a sudden, people are telling them something different. And, you know, that transcends sports, right? I mean, that's always going to be an issue, I think, just for humans.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's definitely the case. We kind of wanted to ask a bit about sort of how you get an idea of what's average, getting benchmarks within the StatCast data with things like exit velocity and launch angle. If you were kind of giving people things to look out for, if they were saying, well, that ball came off the bat at 28 degrees, is that good? What would you say is the Goldilocks zone for people to be looking out for? And would you say that changes within ballpark and season and perhaps even country next year?
Yeah, you hit on something very important. I mean, context is just so important for all of this. And I think it's really difficult, especially when it's a new metric on a new scale, to explain that to people. Like with exit velocity, you know, it's not that dissimilar from pitch velocity. So you kind of have a rough idea that 100 miles an hour is good, right? But, you know, for something like spin rate, that's a big complicated number that nobody understands. Sprint speed, which we measure in feet per second. So for that, for example, 27 feet per second is league average, 30 is elite, and 23 is terrible. And that's not a scale that anybody knows unless you're intimately familiar with it. So that is a huge part of it for us. And we just had a meeting about this last week. Like, you know, I always mention that context, but I can't expect every broadcaster to know that. And so sometimes they'll just put that number up on the screen with no explanation. And I don't think that does anybody any service. So we're trying to redesign all the graphics so that will automatically happen next year. And I think really just having context for any of this stuff is massively important. And it gets really complicated with something like spin rate, because for most numbers, you might think, you know, a low number is bad and a high number is good, right? Like your bank account, higher is always better. But for something like fastball spin rate, it's not good or bad so much as it just means something different. You know, a high spin rate for a fastball is more of the rising effect. It's correlated to swinging strikes and pop-ups. And a low spin rate is cool too, because you get that sink. You get lots of ground balls. It's the middle of the road league average spin rate that's where you get in trouble, because you don't really get much of anything. And if you don't know that, you're not going to know that. So that's really the tough thing for all of these metrics, is trying to ensure that there's enough context out there and, you know, presenting them in formats where maybe the context lends itself. You know, if you present it in a percentile, maybe, then you know that the 1 to 100th is kind of the boundary there. But yeah, that's really important. And that's the toughest part for sure.
And on sort of a related note, I think there's been kind of a bit of a back and forth this year, certainly that I've seen, with using things like exit velocity, launch angle, or stats like expected WOBA as an effort especially for fantasy players, which I think both of Russell and myself are big fantasy guys, in an effort to predict the future and say, well, we think this guy's going to be putting up fantasy stats. You know, maybe he's been unlucky so far, but this is the way forward. You know, he's going to break out in a few months. But perhaps the predictiveness of these stats doesn't quite match the way that a lot of people have been using them. So I kind of wanted to ask first, are there any plans for kind of a more Statcast-based projection system or a metric that's more specifically designed to be predictive rather than descriptive?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think if we have a weakness in anything, it's maybe not great at naming things. Naming is really difficult if you think about it. Your expected weighted on base, I know there's a whole kerfuffle about the predictiveness of it. It wasn't really built to be predictive. If it was, it would have been built in a different, more complicated way. Probably fair to say that, you know, our name isn't the most intuitive as far as what it's supposed to do. So fair enough. As far as whether there are projection tools in the future, I mean, not imminently. Like, there's maybe like 1,000 things we want to do, and only so many of us to do it. So I could definitely see that happening in the future, or maybe we might partner with an existing projection tool like Steamer or somebody like that who does a really good job. But yeah, it's really supposed to explain a little bit more about what has happened, and then, you know, you might be able to infer what the reasons for those changes might be. But yeah, it's not explicitly supposed to be a predictive system.
So you mentioned that there are 1,000 ideas going around the MLB Statcast office. Is there anything that we should expect in the not too distant future? I know at the start of this season, you talked about maybe in some infield play probabilities, and there was maybe some more discussions on getting more information on the speed of players. So actually like their bursts when they come out of the batter's box.
Yeah. Well, we do plan on having a fingers crossed infield defense metric before the end or before the start of next season. You know, any new metric like that is always interesting because, you know, it's not like we're going to suddenly say that, you know, Matt Chapman is bad and Mikel Andujar is great, because I think everybody knows that. I'm hopeful this will do a little bit better with the shifting and positioning that's been a bit of an issue for previous metrics. So I'm excited about that. It's also going to be cool because, you know, we can show performance at spots on the field regardless of position. And what I mean by that is, if Manny Machado is, you know, playing the regular shortstop spot as a shortstop one day, and then he's playing in the exact same spot as a shifted over third baseman the next day, well, what's really the difference there? You know, he's standing in the same spot, so we'll be able to report it like that, which is cool. As you mentioned, we're also going to have some. Both for base running also, but I'm more excited about it for the outfield. Going beyond just sprint speed to reaction time and burst and route running, which I think is going to be really cool. They're replacing some of the day one metrics from 2015 that, you know, didn't really work out. So you'd be able to have scouting reports. Like, this guy is, you know, 80th percentile speed, but his instincts are, you know, his routes are terrible, but his reaction time is fantastic, or whatever the case may be. So that's some of the things we're going to have out there this winter or maybe next spring. And I'm excited about that.
This is probably quite a broad question and maybe a bit difficult to answer, but I wondered what your thoughts were on how much you think we've improved at evaluating players because of Statcast, or would you not even say that yet? Do you think we need more time and more data and more experience before we know if that's the case?
Probably both. I think in the grand scheme of things, you know, 4 years is really not that much time, especially since the first year was, you know, very much a learning process and a work in progress. So I'm certainly not going to, you know, sit here and say every problem ever has been fixed because of this data. That's clearly not true. But I do think that it helps us get to some answers a little more quickly. I like it probably more than anything as a scouting tool. You know, I don't need to see somebody throw 100 curveballs to know if he's got a great spin rate or not. You know, in the same way, I don't need to see 100 fastballs to know that Noah Syndergaard throws hard. You know, so I really like that. And I think what you're seeing teams do, smart teams, is, you know, find that raw skill set and figure out a way to improve these guys. Like, if you have, let's say, a very high spin curveball, but your curveball gets hit, well, I can't teach you how to add spin to your curveball, but I might be able to teach you how to use it differently. You know, maybe change your arm action or tunnel it better with your fastball. And you might not have even thought to look at this guy 5 or 10 years ago, because he wouldn't have popped out on this leaderboard because we wouldn't have had spin rate data. So in just in terms of identifying these raw skills, of foot speed and you know, hard hitting ability, I think that has really helped in just a short period of time. I think that's been pretty cool.
Yeah, that's cool. Being a kind of a fairly stats based person, I like to do some of my own analysis. I obviously write for Buffs and Nerds to do some of that. My question is more like, do you have any plans to make any more raw data publicly available? Because obviously I do consume the 720 odd thousand balls in play that you thankfully put up every single season. But is there any chance for anything more for the general public soon?
Yeah, I get that question a lot, as you can imagine. And the first thing I always say that I want to make explicitly clear is whoever makes those decisions are about 70 levels above my head. I think people have this idea that like I'm the decision maker here, and I am extremely not. The answer to that question is, you know, when the system first came online a couple years ago, I think the commissioner wanted to sort of split the difference. You know, he wanted to make sure that the teams had what they needed to, you know, use the data to improve, you know, their internal processes, but also obviously there's a huge value in having a lot of this out there for fans. So we are right now following the mandate he laid out to sort of have a little bit of both. It would not surprise me if at some point in the future, more data is made available. I certainly don't have a specific date or kind of data or anything like that, but it wouldn't surprise me if that happens at some point.
Well, personally, I'd like to see more of the sprint speed metrics. I love there was one of the graphs which Darren put on Baseball Savant showing kind of how you calculate the sprint speed, and you see all of the graph. You see the graph of like all of Jose Altuve's runs to first base and
yeah,
all the different speeds. Like to see that data, I know that's a lot of data, but that would be amazing to see kind of, oh, did he hustle on that play? Did he not hustle on that play? Getting to first base.
Yeah, I want that too. I've made some suggestions for Darren of how we can present more of that in a different way. And that's cool, because that's something that we don't really need to ask for, you know, approval on. We can just sort of do that if we want to. That's a little different than, you know, dumping like an entire giant file of data. But we have some ideas on how to improve that, because I think it's cool. It's interesting to know like when guys hustle and don't. And I'm excited to see the kind of new stuff we'll have out there for that.
So I wanted to ask about a few specific players, because there have been quite a few who've kind of got extra attention, I would say, in the articles or on the pod, because of particular Statcast metrics. Guys like Franchi Cordero, Seth Lugo, and his curveball spin, of course. And Luis Perdomo is a guy I really associate with the Statcast pod after today. So I'm asking this a little bit for Tom, because he's like a closet Padres fan. So firstly, do you think that he's ever going to come good on that Statcast promise that he's shown for all these years? And secondly, just if you have any other sleeper players, guys that you'd kind of like to highlight, or maybe just guys that you'd like to talk to about something that you've seen in the Statcast data that really interests you.
Yeah, Luis Perdomo is kind of a fun one. That's he's like the pet find of my co-host Matt Myers on the podcast. And it just, you know, he's one of those guys that the success hasn't really been there. But every time we would run some sort of query, he would pop up for something like slider swing and miss rate or low spin two-seamer and getting tons of ground balls. And I know he was hurt this last year. So it's kind of fun to identify these guys who've had these skills. I'm not going to sit here and say I think Luis Perdomo has an all-star future ahead of him, because there's lots of guys who have skills who haven't turned it into production, whether that's spin or, you know, even throwing 100 miles an hour. That doesn't guarantee you're going to be a productive major leaguer, but the skill is there. The one guy I've been thinking about a lot, and I probably talked about this in the podcast at some point, is Ahmed Rosario from the Mets. If you look at his surface level stats, they're kind of bad, and they were kind of bad the year before too. And I remember writing this article in the middle of the season where I was just trying to find the guys who had improved the most from 17 to 18 in expected weighted on base. And it was mostly the guys you'd expect, right? Matt Kemp was off to a great start, and Mookie Betts had a fantastic season. And Ahmed Rosario showed up on this list, and it was weird because I couldn't explain it. I couldn't figure out why, but you know, his numbers were all pointing up, and he was still bad for like 2 months after that. So it made me look kind of silly. But then he ended the season actually pretty well. And he's still so young, and he's like top 10 in sprint speed. And there's still this small part of me that's like, this guy was a top prospect like 18 months ago, and Mets fans were losing their minds that he hadn't been called up yet. So I still have some hope for him. Like, I don't think he's going to be Francisco Lindor or anything like that, but he's the kind of guy that I look past, you know, a 280 on base. And I have a little bit more hope for the future because of those underlying metrics.
It's quite funny that you say that one, because I actually added him into my fantasy team after your article. I thought, oh my God, what have I done for a couple of months? And then when he ended the season fantastic, I was just like, yeah, Mike, get in there. It's the right one.
Yeah, I highlight the one I maybe got right and try to ignore all the ones I have not.
To be honest, I was half expecting you to mention Daniel Palka there with his barrel rate.
I like Daniel Palka. He's a big, beefy boy who crushes baseballs, but he's limited, right? He's an atrocious fielder. He's a DH only. And if you can live with that, he'll get you 30 home runs, but he might strike out 200 times doing it. I do like Daniel Palka. And he also just seems like a fantastic human being, which is always the kind of guy I like to root for.
Yeah, I just want to quickly ask you a couple of questions about barrel rate. So if you go on MLB, it talks about it being Tom Tango's piece of work with some help from a couple of guys. So how much time and effort did you and the team kind of spend into creating a whole new statistic like that about the barrel? Because it's not just it's quite a complicated thing to actually articulate what it is actually about.
Yeah, we were thinking about that. Matt and I were, before Tom was even on board, just kind of like this idea of the perfect batted ball, because exit velocity is super important, of course, but you know, it doesn't matter that much if you are pounding a ball into the ground or hitting it straight up if you've hit it very, very hard. So it's really this combination of exit velocity and launch angle. That's where you really get the value. And Matt and I were, you know, we're not mathematicians. So we were originally thinking about it in kind of just a very, you know, square bounded thing. Like, I forget what we had it, maybe like 100 miles an hour and between like 10 and 30 degrees, because that sort of seemed right. But, you know, we're not math majors here. And then Tom is a statistician. So he came in and he did, you know, a little more complicated work. And he's like, listen, the boundaries for this should start here. And I think it's 98 between 26 and 30. And it's not a square. It's more of a triangle. As exit velocity goes up, the bounds of launch angle that are acceptable go up as well. And we really, you know, we defined it as a ball that's a hit at least half the time and that has a slugging percentage of at least 1500 on it. And it's kind of cool because you can get up there and crush a baseball and do everything right and still not find success, you know. And in the box score, it's an 0-for-1, and I might have pounded a ball 400 feet. And just because, I don't know, Billy Hamilton breached over the fence to rob me of it, it sucks for me, but that's still skill involved in doing that. And I find value in knowing you even have the capability to hit a ball like that. So that's kind of where that started. And yeah, it was our idea, but Tom really helped us ideate it in a more mathematically valid way.
Yeah, I feel that Gary Sanchez is probably the highest example for last season of being unlucky with that BABIP. His barrel rate was still fantastic, but he just was hitting straight at like the outfielder. So I watched one where it was like 150 mile an hour and it just went straight to left field. And you're like, that's about as unlucky as you can get.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to use the term luck, but yeah, there's certainly guys like that. I mean, you know, Gary Sanchez is not fast. He's always going to have a low BABIP. But, you know, you watch enough of those plays, especially you can kind of create like a highlight reel of them in order. If you go look at, you know, expected outcomes on Baseball Savant, and you're like, man, this guy's smoking the ball and it's just not happening for him. So, you know, he's too talented to keep hitting like that, I would hope, but we'll see.
As you're making content for the MLB, do you have to be aware of not showing bias towards certain teams? And if so, is that any more to when you previously worked for ESPN or Fangraphs?
I don't think it's more or less. I mean, it's different if you write for a team site, you know, and you're writing about, I mean, way back in the day, I wrote for a Dodgers blog. So I probably had a little bit of Dodgers bias because that's the team I grew up following. But yeah, if you're getting out of a team specific site to any national outlet, whether it's MLB or ESPN or anywhere, you should probably not be showing that sort of bias. And it's not hard to hide, I don't think, because at this point, you know, it's my job. So I still like the Dodgers. I would still like to see them win sometime. But I don't cheer for them as strenuously as I certainly did. And I don't think you'll find any writer out there for a national outlet, or any good one anyway, who is showing bias. I think my favorite thing on the internet might be someone went through all of Buster Olney's mentions and found an example of someone from each of the 30 fan bases claiming that he hated their team. Really entertaining. And it was just like a perfect encapsulation of what people sort of think. It's like, I can dislike a move your team made because it was a bad move, not because I don't like your team. I think that's the problem we always run into.
I think I can guarantee the first time, every time Buster Olney puts a tweet up about what the next Sunday night game is going to be, the first thing somebody is going to tweet is like, why is it always the Yankees? And it isn't. But that's usually the first tweet. People, is like,
I could say I have a fascination with the Rockies, right? I'm not a Rockies fan, but I love Coors Field. Just like everything about it is so interesting to me. And I can tell you, anytime we write about the Rockies, the traffic levels are terrible. People just don't read about them. And, you know, I know that that's sort of self-fulfilling. You keep showing the Yankees and Red Sox, and that's what people will end up cheering for. But I was pleased when I saw that we were sending games over to the UK, that it was the Yankees and Red Sox. You know, like, if we're going to send teams over, let's send our best teams. Like, I wouldn't have necessarily wanted to see, like, I don't know, the Royals and Reds being the first team. You know, I'm glad it is these two big teams, and I know not everybody probably agrees with that, but I think it's kind of cool.
It's very interesting you say that about the Rockies. Listening to some other podcasts, Ben Lindbergh and both Jeff Sullivan both say the same thing, that anytime they write anything about the Rockies, the traffic goes down.
Yeah, right, exactly.
I kind of wanted to end on something that's kind of getting topical, and touch on the Hall of Fame a bit. Obviously, Harold Baines has been in the news today for quite controversially sneaking into the Hall of Fame.
Yeah,
and we're obviously going to get more and more over the next few weeks with people putting out their ballots and the votes coming through. So I kind of wanted to ask what you thought the role in the future of StatCast and similar advanced data was going to be. Do you think that in 20 years we're going to see people citing someone's outs above average or their sprint speed when they're making their Hall of Fame decisions, or is that too hard to picture right now?
I will answer that question, but first I want to say something about Harold Baines really quick. I, like, as we probably all agree, is one of the most egregious selections in Hall of Fame history. But the thing that bothers me here, I don't know Harold Baines, but I know people who do, and they all say he's just like the most lovely person. And it bothers me now that we're all just going to be dumping on this guy's shining moment, which sucks. He doesn't belong in the Hall of Fame, but man, that guy gets to say I'm a Hall of Famer, and I feel bad now that, like, we're going to be turning this conversation into screw Harold Baines. It's completely unfair, and it was a bad process that led to a bad selection. To your actual question, not yes, but not soon, right? I mean, anybody who is young enough to have decent in their prime StatCast data isn't going to be on the Hall of Fame ballot for 15, 20 years, right? And I don't think necessarily you probably would look at something like outs above average or whatever stat we're using at the time, because people look at defensive runs saved now in Hall of Fame discussions or UZR. And if people deem that the StatCast metrics are an improvement on that, I think, you know, we're going to look at that. I don't know that anyone's going to go into the Hall of Fame just because they had a high exit velocity or a high expected anything, because I do think in the end, it's all about actual on the field production. But if there are any metrics that are accounting for that, and I think, you know, anything's fair game. And I think as time goes on, hopefully the people making the selections will take advantage of any information or data source that's available to them. I don't think any ballot should ever just be about StatCast. That's not really the goal of the Hall of Fame. But certainly if there's a point in the future where, you know, people have votes and the information helps inform that decision, then yeah, I do expect people to use that.
Great, yeah. Interesting world, I think, the voting scene with in 15, 20 years time.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, I'm slated to get a vote in 6-7 years. I can't remember. And I'll be interested to see if we still have it. It wouldn't surprise me if we all complain too much and they just take the vote away from us.
Well, will you be voting on Jay Jaffe's Fangraph Hall of Fame ballot this year?
I don't know. Jay's a good friend of mine. I've known him for a long time. I should probably go and do that. I haven't yet, but I always tweet out my hypothetical ballot. And I think I saw today someone, in theory, has not voted for Mariano Rivera, which actually makes me happy because I don't have to spend the next 3 weeks talking about unanimous selections. Because while he's great, he should not be the first unanimous guy, nor should anybody really.
Yeah, the Google Translate of that tweet was suggesting that a person doesn't think closers are any good. So, or the user
well, that's
closers.
A bad reason. That's,
yeah.
That's not a good reason.
Yeah, I think unless you have anything else, Russell, I think that's about all of the questions we have time for.
Yeah, that's all of the time for here. I could probably ask questions for another 2 hours, to be perfectly honest. But
yeah, well, prepared to be asked for data for the next 3 hours, Mike. That's the rest of the podcast.
Oh, great. Yeah, I look forward to that for sure. My only disappointment is that there will not be any of the gear set up, far as I know, in the stadium in England. So we won't get any good data from those games.
Yeah, sadly, I don't think that's in the works, although obviously we'll push for it if we get the opportunity to. For two games, they might not want to set everything up.
Yeah, probably not.
Right, so I guess if you can just tell everybody where they can find you on Twitter or anywhere else you'd like to let people find you, and if there's anything we should be looking out for coming from the MLB.com team in the next few weeks.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Mike_Petriello, P-E-T. R-I-E-L-L-O. After the holidays and, you know, into January and February, we'll be pushing out some of our new metrics. And I'm really excited about that. So, you know, please feel free to hit me up or any of our guys on the team at any time. We'd love to get feedback from fans. And like I said, this unknown to me, like UK baseball community, like that loves the Rays and Astros, apparently. I'm just fascinated and stoked to hear from them. I think it's the coolest.
I think there's a certain element of the UK fan enjoying sort of picking the underdog. A lot of people have kind of, I think, either they just go over and they pick the team that they go and see, or they, you know, don't want to be that guy who picks the Red Sox or the Yankees or the team who keeps winning all the time. So I think a lot of them,
yeah,
the Astros while they're down, and I think the Rays sort of perennially feel like the underdog team, don't they? So,
well, I think you're right. I asked people about that, and several of them said they just go vacation to Florida, and so they've seen Rays games, and I guess that makes sense to me.
Yeah. Okay. Well. Thank you very much for joining us, Mike. This has been really good, and I hope people do check out the podcast and your work, because we always really enjoy it. And there's a ton of fascinating stuff. If you're at all interested in the stats, then I think people will learn a lot, and I'm sure there'll be lots more exciting things to come in the years down the line.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for having me, Mike.
Thank you.
Okay, and you can find the podcast on Twitter at @batflips_nerds. And we have got some more very exciting guests in the pipeline, so keep a lookout for those, and we'll talk to you next time.